Roundtable Podcasts, underwritten by Proctors, the Capital Region's premier performing arts center featuring the best in entertainment from Broadway and around the globe. Proctors.org.
Joshua Safran is an attorney in the Bay Area and one of the subjects of the critically acclaimed documentary Crime After Crime, a moving film about his and his partner's efforts to free a battered woman from prison. The riveting and dramatic courtroom story got picked up by both OWN Network and Sundance Film Festival and won numerous awards. What wasn't told in the film was just as dramatic and heartbreaking, Joshua's own story, which in no small measure explains why he took on the case in the first place. Now in his book Free Spirit, Growing Up on the Road and Off the Grid, Safran has written a powerful and eloquent memoir that shows the darker side of the age of Aquarius. Like many in her generation in the 1970s, Safran's mother was caught up in the search for what she believed would be a new age of peace and love. But when utopia didn't flower as expected, she found herself pregnant and single, giving birth to Safran amidst a coven of witches in a commune. The name of the book is Free Spirit, Growing Up on the Road and Off the Grid, and it's a great pleasure to welcome Joshua Safran to the roundtable this morning.
Joe, thanks for having me.
This is a fascinating story. At what point did you decide that you wanted to share it with the public at large?
You know, I never wanted to share all of this story. The first part of my life, sort of born into a coven of witches, hitchhiking across the American West with my mother, you know, was a story that I told bits and pieces of here, much to the delight of amazed people at cocktail parties. Growing up without electricity and running water and living in an ice cream truck were some of my friends' favorite stories. But the second half of Free Spirit is a little bit of a darker tale, and this is where my mother pairs up with a violent alcoholic guerrilla rebel fighter, shaman, poet, healer. I really didn't have the desire or the courage to tell that story until I began representing a woman who was in prison for life for killing her batterer, for killing the man who had abused her. And as part of that process of getting her to talk to me about her experiences, I figured out I had to tell her about my experiences. And at that point, we were sharing our stories. And she was really the first one that I ever told or talked about these things with, even including my mother, who had gone through these experiences with me, but we had never talked about it. So once I sort of began talking to her, that came at a time when there was a lot of news media coverage about the case, and the San Francisco Chronicle called and wanted to do a profile on this woman's legal team, and I knew that would include, the question, why did you take this case? Why is a man interested in domestic violence issues? So I told them, nope, I'm not interested in doing this interview. And it was actually my client, Deborah Piegler, who kind of looked at me and she's like, are you kidding? You told me that me telling my story was really important and we had to be brave and we would break this cycle of violence and educate the world, and now you won't tell your story and you're a man. And and she kind of threw the race card at me. She was like, a lot of people think that domestic violence only happens to poor black women in South Central LA. And, so at that point I was like, all right, fine, I have to do it. And then when I first told this story, I was really afraid. I was like, I work in a I'm a lawyer by day, and I worked in this fancy law firm with bleached white carpets and free beverages. And, it's kind of like, oh, no, I can't let all that into this world. And, it did get a little weird. Some of my colleagues, I think, looked at me like, oh, this guy is really damaged goods now, But a lot of people, the majority of people were really like, oh, you're a hero. Thanks for telling your story. And then over time, there was a movie that went to Sundance about my representation of this woman, and at that point people were coming up and telling me that it was affecting their lives in a positive way that we were telling these stories. So I figured, okay, I now have like, the Lord's work as part of the reason to tell this story. So and that's when I felt it was time to write the book.
That film, of course, is Crime After Crime, and I guess it's safe to say that you wouldn't have fallen into this line of work had it not been for your background.
That is very safe to say. My training is in land use and real estate work, and that's my comfort zone. I don't even like to get into tax law or anything that I don't know as much about. So representing a convicted killer serving life in prison was not part of that. But when this woman's biography became clear to me. I sort of leapt at the opportunity. In the beginning, I didn't even articulate even to myself why I was so interested in the case, but I saw in this woman basically a metaphorical continuation of what had happened to my mother, and we were in a situation where I myself was plotting to kill my stepfather. So I very much saw that it could have been me on the other side of those bars.
Was your mother at all helpful in understanding more about the case that you were working so hard on?
I mean, I think my mother wasn't actively helpful in that sense, but unless you've been in a home with family violence in it, it's often hard to understand these stories. And so when, you know, a lot of people, they look at this and they say, well, if he was beating her, why wouldn't she just leave? Or why would she love someone who was being violent? Or why would, you know, et cetera. And so I think that my own experience of having come through it allowed me to sort of understand both what she went through and, you know, how and why she went through it. And then also, most importantly, be able to translate that for the court and for people who don't have experience in those kind of relationships to explain, well, this is why, you know, she couldn't leave because of this. Because I had been there myself, I was able to do that.
The name of the book is Free Spirit, and Spirit has a lot to do with this story and that journey of the spirit. And how much of that is conscious and how much of it is doing it and then realizing what had happened afterwards?
My mother very much identified with the idea of being a free spirit, and she was sort of the dictionary definition of a free spirit, someone living without rules, outside the confines of society, in fact, being sort of what she considered the counterculture, like a separate culture apart. And I think for me that free spirit, you know, I grew up kind of having a negative connotation with that particular lifestyle and wanting rules and wanting to be, you know, subscribing to like Orthodox Judaism and, you know, sort of rebelling. So I think in a way I took, in my own way, free spirit was my rebellion from the counterculture or my countercultural self, and in that way I felt like I actually freed my spirit from the slavery or the captivity of how dark a place you can go to if you do grow up without rules.
And how much of that, though, is marked by what happened with your stepfather, in the sense of how much of it is living without rules and how much of it is the situation that you were in with this one man?
Yeah, I think, you know, the first part of Free Spirit, the first part of my childhood, when I look back on it now, I wince because I have kids of my own and I think, oh my goodness, you know, if my child was, you know, firing rifles and smoking cigarettes at the age of 7, I would have, you know, I don't know what I would do to myself with myself. But I think you're right in the sense that all of the things that make me shiver looking back at that part of my childhood are sort of what ifs, because at the end of the day, I was a, you know, mostly happy kid enjoying that kind of freedom, not having a bedtime, not going to school, and in a sense that was all fine. And I think that the story might have been different, and I probably wouldn't have even told the story had it just sort of remained that way and then one day I like got out and went to college or something. But I did feel, you know, my mother, for what it's worth, did sort of have an escalating series of relationships with escalatingly strange men, so that by the time my stepfather came around on some level, I kind of felt like it was inevitable that we would meet up with this guy, because one of the ironies about my mother is she's this sort of radical feminist at the sort of forefront of the women's movement, you know, so attuned to sexism that I couldn't even watch TV because like everything was sexist. And then the guy that she was really searching for was sort of this militant Che Guevara, super manly, super machismo guy who, you know, invariably was, who wasn't a feminist, but rather a bully. And you know, in my mother's mind, that somehow worked. And that was hard for me to understand, being brought up with the sort of feminist ideal and then having a guy who was anything but.
How profound is it to have your mother comment and share with you her views about your childhood and ultimately apologize.
It was an amazing experience. I mean, I think I would recommend that everyone interview their parents about the details of their childhood, because even in a childhood not as extreme and kind of crazy as my own, it provides this amazing context to so much of your memory. You know, you'll have an experience where you'll remember, my mother was really angry at me because I dropped the spoon on the floor. And of course, when you interview your mother, you realize, well, of course she wasn't mad about the spoon. She was mad about something else, and that's how it channeled it. But in your own mind, you're always thinking, I shouldn't have dropped that spoon, or, you know. So that was profound, and it was also, you know, I interviewed her for a couple of years, and to sort of go back through her every parenting decision and every experience we had was, I have to say, the absolute cheapest and most effective form of therapy that I've ever heard of, because it's like it just requires you to rethink everything. And I think in that process, we really grew closer and we really resolved so much of the unspoken distance that was between us.
Is therapy a part of it as well, though?
I think it is. I mean, I'm someone who has never participated in like a formal therapy, and I think that in a way, Free Spirit was kind of accidentally like a really great form of therapy. And I think for myself in particular, my own unresolved issues weren't so much with my mother, but rather my own feelings of guilt and shame about not protecting her. And, you know, as an adult intellectually, I can say, well, I was only 9 and 10 and 11 and 12. So, of course, I shouldn't or couldn't have been expected to stand up for her. But in my own mind, I still very much carried so much guilt about my inability to protect her and what that said about me as a man. So I think the book was most, the writing process was most powerful and most intense for me going into those episodes and going into my own memory and my mind about what I'm feeling as my mother's being beaten, for example, and my own sense of self-loathing that I'm not protecting her, and yet my own fear that I don't want to get involved. And I think that was absolutely the hardest part of telling the story.
Your work continues on behalf of women who survive domestic violence, legal work that you do. How is that fulfilling to you in the sense of, because in one way it goes to, yes, solve a problem, hopefully, but also to really rekindle all that you had gone through?
Yeah, I think for me on a, you know, intellectual level, I think it when you know what an injustice feels like, when you know what a wrong feels like, there's something just deeply satisfying about like helping to fix it and helping to make the world a better place. And you feel like on some level you're reaching back into time and helping each woman that you help out or each kid that you help out is somehow helping yourself. You know, if only I had been there when I was in need, now I'm here, you know. But I think on another level, and this is one of the insights I had when I wrote Free Spirit, was on another level, I think in a certain sense, I'm kind of proving to my childhood self that I'm now brave enough and strong enough to help people in need like this. So I think some of it is I'm sort of pushing myself. but the other part of it too, I think, is that once it's really hard to quantify the feeling that you have when you help someone who's in sort of a life or death situation, a psychological situation where they're just, you know, really in hell, and then you kind of intervene, especially when it's someone who's in prison and you get them out of prison. I mean, you feel like, I don't have to give money to homeless people for a year. I'm doing really righteous work. I mean, it just feels so good to do it. And I think I've become a little bit of a junkie in that feeling of good deeds that comes from the work.
Well, the name of the book is Free Spirit, Growing Up on the Road and Off the Grid. It is published by Hyperion. Joshua Safran, I thank you very much for sharing with us this morning.
Joe, thank you very much for having me.
Again, the title of the book, Free Spirit, published by Hyperion. You're listening to The Roundtable on WAMC.